Swedish British journalist, filmmaker, political writer, and author of 5 books, Pelle Nyroff Taylor, on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome to the second hour of the Pelle Nyroff Taylor Show on this Thursday, April afternoon. We've got healthcare and personal themes in this second hour. Our first guest is Roger Whittaker, the founder of madinamerica.com, a website that features research and news and blogs by an international group of writers interested in rethinking psychiatry. Does psychotherapy and popping pills actually work? What does the science say, and what can be done about the situation where we seem to be imbibing in eating medicines to improve our mood like never before in history? Now, when we've got a new picture of how the pharma industry actually works because of the COVID pandemic or whatever you want to call it, then maybe we should turn to pharmaceutical industry's other products. Is the unprecedented level of depression related not to the popping of pills rather than the fact that we are not eating enough pills? Obviously, creating a demand by creating the problem. We've got Scott Shara next, who's the host of Deprogramming with Grace's Dad podcast. He realized he's been programmed to believe a litany of things that were not true after what he calls the medical murder of his daughter Grace, who's 19 years old and had Down syndrome when she died. He wants to bring the truth about the world, about what really goes on in hospitals and the cynical triage operations that go on behind our backs. We'll see if he can support that, but it's definitely a very sad story about what happened with his daughter. That's on later in the second half of this program. Just another mention of a festival this time. It's a couple of weeks later than the one I mentioned in the first hour. It's called StandInTheLight.UK, which is happening between the 24th and 27th of May, which is a long bank holiday weekend in the UK. And it's on in the Lake District. The exact location you'll find out on the website, I guess. It's £60 for 4 nights camping with Truth and Freedom people. So it includes 30 artists, including Danny Rampling and Mobius Loop, an all-night acoustic fire pit, bouncy castles and Hope Sussex for the children, loads of amazing stalls and scrumptious food vendors. So this is a music festival, and it aims at appealing to those who like the sort of things we talk about on this show, as well as a lot of dancing, I guess. Before we talk to Basil for this second now, I'll just mention a little bit about what's going on about Iran. I was looking just before this, before my show. Obviously, it's one of those events that might change world history. Not to put too fine a point about it. Lavrov has just been in China, the Russian foreign secretary, and coordinating with Wang Yi, and we've got Putin going to China next month. Probably what's discussing whether China will have Russia's back and Iran's back if it all goes very pear-shaped in either Ukraine with boots on the ground there from the West, or Israel being supported by America on a strike on Iran. If Iran strikes Israel in this, I mean, sometimes you think it's like children in a playground, but we've got nuclear weapons at stake. Nuclear war is the big risk. And we've got, I don't know, I've been trying to read the tea leaves. There's only so much you can do. I thought it was very encouraging that not only Mike Johnson snubbed British Foreign Secretary Dave Cameron coming with his begging bowl in Washington last week, but also Jake Sullivan, who's actually administration number 3 in national security, whatever, maybe sending a signal to Cameron, maybe sending a signal to the Russians. I don't know. Sort of saying, because I always thought that I assume that no one wants expansion of the war in the East. And from what I heard yesterday and I heard elsewhere, is that the Russians are pulling very hard at the Iranians, and with the Chinese pulling on the other end. To not have Iran escalate, probably perhaps with comparison to the Russians' rather muted response to the Crocus City bombings a few weeks ago, which killed 160 people, whereas this latest attack killed 7 people, albeit top-ranking Iranian diplomats and generals, but still. So I'm kind of hoping, I don't know, there might not be a very significant Iranian strike at all. Probably they have to do something for prestige's sake, but it might not be as big as we think. Let's hope. I could be proved wrong in the next 24 or 48 hours. But that means also perhaps for the Americans snubbing or pulling back their own vigorous hawks on the European side, the French and the British, just as in return for the Russians and the Chinese restraining the Iranians. That's a theory, and I have no particular proof for it, but we'll see what happens anyway in the next few days. But we'll have Basil with us, Basil Valentine, our political editor, with more of news analysis and banter after a very quick break. This is the Pelle Neros-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Abroad or at home, this is your news.
By staying silent, we are part of the problem.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello, Basil. How is it going? What have we got for us today on the Pelle Neros-Taylor Show?
A new name today, Pelle. Paul Saint-Pierre Plamondon. Do you have any idea who he is?
No, I don't. You caught me out on that one.
He's a Canadian lawyer, television columnist, and politician who, since October 2020, has been the leader of the Parti Québécois. And the whole question of Quebec ceding from Canada is back on the agenda. He's only 47 years old. He's very photogenic. He's the Generation X TikToker that could see the end of Canada as we know it. His party won a by-election in the Quebec City area riding of Jean Talon, long a stronghold of the governing coalition Avenir Quebec. So, you know, back on the agenda, possibly Quebec leaving Canada.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I'm sure it won't be long before he's being accused of being funded by the Russians and the Chinese. Surely that's only a matter of time, you know?
Yes.
But
yeah, that's a good point.
Because obviously Trudeau is one of the surfer dude with no qualifications to his name, apart from his surname. Justin Trudeau is at daggers drawn with Xi in China. There's a large, huge Chinese community in Canada. So obviously the Canadian establishment are horrified by this. I used to be, I don't know about you, but I've always had a thing about the French, against the French. I remember in Brussels, you know, there's always this thing that which language is the lingua franca of the EU institutions. And I always spoke in English. I refused to speak French, even though I speak it. And the French journalists always refused to speak English. So I've always had this ding dong with French people. And I was always against Quebec seceding. But now I said, well, why not? You know, I mean,
I thought
you can't
I thought General Wolfe won the decisive victory in 1763, didn't he?
Yeah, I know, but I mean, I'm host. I mean, the French irritate me, and Quebecers even more. But you know, you can't sort of say, well, Britain has to be independent of the EU, and then the Quebec has to stay in Canada. It's self-determination, is it not?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, strangely, there are eerie parallels with the Ukraine, aren't there? These borders that sort of corral populations into administrative areas that they don't necessarily agree with, historic
exactly.
Sort of colonial borders. It's
exactly.
Absolutely ridiculous, really, that we're still talking about them in this day and age. Well, and the principle of self-determination should override anything else. Go on.
Well it didn't in Africa when they all became independent in 1960. And maybe it should have been, because it was simpler just to keep the state borders established by the colonial powers. But it meant that every country was a mishmash of tribes who didn't really like each other, you know?
Yes.
And they've never been able to create a functioning democracy, because everyone just votes with their tribe, which means you have permanent
yes.
majorities of the tribal largest tribe, basically. You didn't have
occasionally, obviously, the massacre of one tribe by another, you know.
Yeah, right. So, what the pro-Ukrainians never mention is the fact that, you know, it was a hodgepodge. Ukraine is an artificial creation from 1922, which had a lot of Russian-speaking regions added to it. simply to divide and conquer, I guess. Or it didn't matter. The Soviet Union thought it was going to last forever.
Yes,
and
exactly.
The Russians, and I've been to Ukraine before, long before the war. The first thing I heard from the people in Lviv is, we hate those animals in eastern Ukraine. And then in eastern Ukraine, the Russians, I saw them as Russians. They saw themselves as Russians, more or less. They say, well, we don't understand why they hate. They were less aggressive. But there was no love lost between those two sides back then. That was long before, that was even before Putin, you know. So why?
Yeah, so, I mean, Stalin used to just sort of move people around the Soviet Union at will, didn't he? You know, where they're setting up industrial towns, just to, people were sort of frog marched from across vast distances to suit his own sort of industrial or military ends, you know. And the Ukrainian population is a legacy of that. The Ukrainians are now complaining they are being outnumbered 7-10 by Russian forces, according to General Yuri Sodol, who was addressing Parliament today. Now, the Ukrainians have passed a controversial bill that is going to change the rules on civilian military mobilization in an attempt to address their dreadful manpower shortages on the front line. I don't know why they don't sue for peace. Dmitry Peskov said today that any negotiations on Ukraine without Russia are meaningless, which, of course, they are.
It's crazy. So why? I mean, so what if Ukraine loses 20% of its population? They don't want to be part of Ukraine anyway. So what's the big deal? You keep 80% of your population, keep 80% of your country, you can join the EU, never join NATO. So what, you know? That's what they could have had.
Exactly.
And they could even have kept those areas if they've played their cards right. Not that they should have wanted them. I mean, the Donbass are 20%. It's like trying to swallow a hedgehog or something after having shelled them for many years. You know, so leave it. I mean, just because they don't, what Ukraine is going to fight for these borders back, but they don't want to join you. Why do it? But don't bother. Just keep your 80%.
I know.
That's what we're fighting for. That's why we're on the edge of a nuclear war that could destroy the whole planet because of these border problems in Eastern Europe that were not resolved after Cold War. And of course, the pro-Ukrainians never say that. They say Putin is invading the whole of Europe next after his unprovoked invasion of Ukraine, as if the state border, as I said, he was protecting, from his perspective, he was protecting the Russians, Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine. History matters. People should learn about history. Helps, you know. Yeah. Anyway.
Last week, Zelensky signed a bill to lower the conscription age from 27 to 25. I would have thought it was already lower than that. And he was backed up by Ukrainian lawmaker Alexander Fedienko, who said the adoption of the new law on mobilization sends a clear message to our partners that we are ready to retake our territory and we need weapons, honestly.
Retake our territory. That's what so take back the Donbass, in other words.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so why? I mean, it's so backwards. I mean, it's like, it's not as if territory matters that much anymore in a world of nowhere people, as we all are, you know, living in as digital nomads and having mass immigration and so on. I mean, I don't know. It's this particular thing is such based on such a crazy premises. But I mean, back to Quebec, I guess. As I said, I mean, emotionally, I'm pro Anglo control over the French. Just said they irritate me enormously. But I have to go with my head on this one. That if they want to break out, they should, but they paid a heavy price because Montreal, the entire business elite of Montreal, left for Toronto in last time this was really on the cards, you know, 1975.
Right.
But interesting, it's amazing. A lot of French. Have you been to Canada?
No, I haven't. No.
A lot of the Quebecois don't speak English at all. It's incredible. You'd think on a continent of 350 million English speakers, you go outside Montreal. But you go to Quebec City and they shrug at you in that very frank French way and astonishment that you presume to speak to them in English, you know. But I guess it's a way of keeping their identity. So if that's what floats their boat, you know.
Yes. Obviously, you know, the British, we didn't do a good enough job of colonizing them, you know. But exactly. back to your point about the battle for language, of course, the French managed to get hold of FIFA. That's a whole story. The Swiss, ultimately, why is it FIFA, Fédération Internationale Football Association, should be the International Association of Football. It should be the IAFF We invented the game, for heaven's sake. And there's long since been this battle for whose language is the universal language. And the simple fact is that English has won. You know, there there was a tussle in the middle of the last century, but English has won.
We've got to wind up there, but I can't resist it. A last jab against the Brexiteers, because when I was in Brussels, the latecomers, the British, had taken over culturally completely, and they said that they were being oppressed, but they were in control of Brussels, I felt. Anyway, I'm not going to give you a chance.
Well, I've got to say very quickly, I am actually a Francophone. I love France. Okay. I love speaking French, and I think French is music to the ears, Pelle.
All right. Well, au revoir, Basil. Speak tomorrow.
Au revoir, Pelle.
This is the Pelle Nero's Taylor Show. We're heading into our first guest of the second hour after a very quick break.
Johnny Vedmore, TNT.
Whenever we examine evidence, we discover a range of new information. And some of the information involving the COVID-19 pandemic is truly uncomfortable. I'm still impressed by the strength of those with medical expertise who are still organizing and fighting for those who have been left behind. There is a change happening in the world, and change is extremely important. People are realizing that it is do or die, and that without a fight, this sort of tragedy will happen again. We must lift the voices of those who have been ignored. And we will be looking for those voices to come on the Johnny Vedmore Show to speak out loud and proud.
Talk that matters. Johnny Vedmore on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
It sounds pretty good.
It sounds real, dude.
Not bad, huh?
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nero's Taylor Show on the second hour of the TNT News Talk Show today. So we're very pleased to have on our show Robert Whittaker, who's the author of 5 books, 3 of which tell the history of psychiatry. In 2010, he's An Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness, won the U.S. Investigative Reporters and Editors Book Award for Best Investigative Journalism. Prior to writing books, he worked as a science reporter. He is a clinical assistant process adjunct at the Lewis Katz School of Medicine at Temple University, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. He's the founder of madinamerica.com, a website that features research news and blogs by an international group of writers interested in rethinking psychiatry. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
What is this? Is it possible to talk about a central thesis in your work about psychiatry?
Well, the central thesis is this, is that, and this begins with American psychiatry, but basically American psychiatry told us a story going back to the 1980s about how chemical imbalances caused mental disorders, and we had drugs that fixed those chemical imbalances like insulin for diabetes. And the problem is this, that's a false narrative. That's not what science shows. So societies around the globe have organized their thinking and their care and their use of psychiatric drugs around a false narrative that tells of drugs that fix pathologies in the brain. And that's just not true. That's the first main theme. And then the second theme is, well, how is this, the fact that we've organized ourselves around a false narrative, how is it playing out in public health outcomes? And public health outcomes are worsening in every developed country that has adopted this narrative of care. So that's the big theme, is that basically psychiatry as an institution, and this does come from American psychiatry, misled us about their own science. And that has had drastic public health outcomes.
Watching a documentary, in which you featured, which very, very clearly shows, I mean, through personal examples, how what is supposed to be the cure for the disease is actually the cause of the disease. And the cynical part of me says, well, if you are a corporation and you want to create demand for your products, you make sure that your product creates the demand for more of that product, you know. So if you create a demand, create a pill that makes you more depressed than you were before, then the solution you can sell is eat even more of those pills and you will get better. And of course, you get worse and then you can have eaten even more pills. So it's actually a drug in the true negative sense of the word. Anyway,
Yeah, no, that's been a very successful model for building a market, to be honest with you. Yeah. You go on an antidepressant, which maybe you just have some sort of setback emotionally that would have cleared up with time. You go on the antidepressant, and the long-term data shows that, in fact, you're increasing the risk you'll remain depressed and increase the risk that you'll become functionally impaired. And then the problem is coming off the drugs can be very hard. You'll suffer withdrawal symptoms. So you do have a mechanism there where you start people and you create long-term customers, which from an economic point of view is a brilliant paradigm for growing your market.
I guess, have you found it? Is it true of all antidepressants? I mean, are you willing to make a distinction and say some are not subjected? I don't know much about the market, as it were, I can't give you brand names and so on. But can you sort of nuance the argument now? You've stated that the bigger case. Can you talk us through
Well, there's a problem with all psychiatric drugs, and this is actually well known in the research literature if you actually dig into it. It's not known to the public. So let's take SSRI antidepressants, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and they're a very popular class of antidepressants, okay? So what they do is they keep serotonin longer in that synaptic gap between neurons, theoretically upping serotonergic activity, right? Well, now, once they understood that mechanism, they hypothesized maybe depression was due to too little serotonin. But they found that prior to going on the medication, you didn't have that problem. But here's the kicker here. Once you go on that medication and it artificially ups serotonergic activity, your brain says, uh-oh, and it has all these feedback loops. It actually dials down its own serotonergic machinery. It decreases its density of receptors and decreases its own output of serotonin. So the irony is the drugs actually, and this is true basically of all psychiatric drugs, over the long term, they induce the very abnormality once hypothesized to cause the problem in the first place. So that's the problem. Mm-hmm. That's the mechanism of action. And you'll see it's called the drugs induce an oppositional tolerance. And so this is a key to all psychiatric drugs. And they say the reason it does this is because the brain is trying to maintain a homeostatic equilibrium, a normal functioning of these things. So that's the problem long term. And it's not specific to any one drug. Now, different antidepressants have different sort of the strength of how they affect serotonin systems. Some affect norepinephrine systems, other systems. But the basic problem is the pathology of mental disorders is unknown. So you basically have no known pathology that you can attack. And then you use these drugs that perturb normal functioning, which causes an opposite reaction. And what we see over the long term over and over again is that although some people do fine on the drugs, that's true, on the whole, in the aggregate, they increase the chronicity of disorders, they increase the risk of functional impairment, and that shows up over and over again in long-term outcome studies and public health.
I mean, I'll declare my enormous bias against these drugs, so I'm totally with you. So I'll play slightly devil's advocate. We've got a news break in about a minute. We'll continue after. Is there a case, how many percentage of the population do these drugs actually work for, and can we isolate those so that for them it works and fine, stick them to that? And secondly, is there a case, even for the people for whom long-term use is bad, for short-term use of those drugs? And is there a mechanism for finding those? Is there work being done on these obvious questions? Because I've just come new to the subject.
Well, so
you've got 20 seconds to answer what you're going to talk about after the break.
Okay, and I'll say those are great questions. And actually, those are questions that go to how to make best use of medications. And we can talk about how that could be done. Unfortunately, right. It isn't being done.
Right. That's incredible. Okay. Well, we've got Robert Whittaker, who is author of 5 books on misuses of psychiatry and medicine. We'll have you on in a minute's time, just after a quick news break. This is Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Question. Huh? What are you guys doing today?
The news.
TNT Radio News.
Sounds good.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Mao Ning stated that the relationship and cooperation between Beijing and Moscow are matters solely for those two nations. Responding to implied threats by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Kurt Campbell regarding the impact of further Russian advances in Ukraine on U.S.-China relations, a coalition of Republican state attorneys general, led by Indiana's Todd Rokita, is challenging comments made by U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland regarding the Department of Justice's involvement in state voting laws.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got Robert Whittaker, whose website, madinamerica.com, I highly recommend if you're critical of the way psychiatry and medicines, antidepressants, are used and misused. He's a science reporter and academic. So, Robert, tell us about the questions we just asked before the break about if it's useful for some people and if it's useful for everyone for a short period of time.
First of all, it's nice you're playing devil's advocate. No, the drugs have not been found to be useful for everyone over the short term, okay? But let's say antidepressants, you do see about 12% of patients that have a good response that otherwise wouldn't have a good response, okay? So one of the things that's happening in the UK now is they're saying, don't use antidepressants as a first-line therapy, try other therapies, environmental therapies, that sort of thing. And if a person doesn't get better, then try them on the antidepressant. And then you can also have this thing that if you do have a response that they didn't have before, that's great. And then, but you still want to try to leave it at a short-term, minimize long-term use. And by the way, there's a very famous psychiatrist in the United States named Nasser Gami. He says, listen, we need to rethink our use of these drugs. There's no evidence they provide a long-term benefit, and we should really be using them as short-term, in shortest time possible, and at the lowest doses possible. So that's actually becoming an idea voiced within psychiatry. It isn't reaching a practice. Now, you also asked about... the question with drugs is always for whom and for how long, okay? And basically, you want to identify the population that can benefit. Now, for example, with antipsychotics, there was a group in northern Finland who developed a form of care where they didn't give antipsychotics to people right away, okay, that were psychotic. And what did they find? They found eventually with just environmental care, about 2/3 could recover from their psychotic episode and never need to go on the antipsychotics. Now, they found another 13% that needed them for a period of time, stabilized, it helped them. And they also found that about 20%, in fact, needed them long-term. So that's an example of care. It's called open dialogue therapy, where they figured out for whom and for how long. And what, and rather than for antipsychotics for everyone right from the beginning, they say they did not put them on antipsychotics right away. Then if they did put them on, they saw who could come off after a period of time. So... Your point is, can these drugs be useful if used smartly and in understanding what they do? The answer is yes, but you would use them mostly short term, and you wouldn't generally use them as first line therapies. You try to minimize rather than maximize their use.
So this Finnish method, the open door therapy, isn't making inroads in larger countries, because Finland is, Scandinavians are often innovators in these kinds of things, but they don't tend to push their therapies in other countries so much. Is the United States beginning to adopt this or think about it?
So open dialogue, once, in fact, Anatomy of an Epidemic was the book that really promoted this therapy to the rest of the world, to be honest with you. And now it has been, it's been adopted in many other countries. It's being exported, it's being tested in the United States, throughout Europe, that sort of thing, Japan. But one of the problems is it involves a sort of intense dialogical therapy where you sort of meet with the patients and their families, et cetera. But the drug use, which was so used, that selective drug use, which was so key to the good outcomes, isn't really being adopted as this mode of care is being exported. The reason it's not being adopted is because often psychiatric associations say in the United States or other countries say, oh, that's malpractice not to give people with psychosis antipsychotics. So you have this institutional resistance to anything that diminishes the use of psychiatric drugs. And at least in the United States, one of the reasons for that is, what do psychiatrists do? They prescribe drugs. They don't do counseling, that sort of thing. So they need to maintain belief in the drugs as a first-line therapy. And that's happening in other countries as well. And we're not seeing as good as outcomes in those other countries. And one other thing is, there's a long line of research going back to the 70s that says this sort of selective use of antipsychotics would produce better outcomes. We had experiments done in the 1970s in the United States. They found the exact same thing.
And is also, isn't medical malpractice a huge issue in the United States? So people are playing, psychiatrists are playing safe, are they? And they're going with the flow somehow. Yeah.
So there was a famous case in the 1990s where doctors did not give a depressed patient's antidepressants, and that person remained depressed. He sued them, and it was seen as malpractice, in essence, not to give them antidepressants, even though that's not what the evidence says. So, and actually psychiatry really embraced that because they knew this would be a lever to say, make antidepressants and antipsychotics the standard form of care, which is what they wanted to see. So psychiatrists actually do have to play it safe, because if someone has a bad reaction to the drug or doesn't do well, that's the disease. They're off the hook. But if someone doesn't get the drug and does bad, then they can say, listen, you failed to provide the form of care they should have.
In a legal sense. Psychiatry, I guess they're like all professionals want to do the best job possible, but isn't it also like a simple solution? You just feed them with drugs and then they can go on to the next patient or go out on sailing on their yacht or whatever. I don't know. I mean, is that sort of, it's the one size fits all makes that you don't have to get so much engaged in the patient. Because I always thought
The financial incentive is to prescribe. So if you're a psychiatrist in the United States, you get paid for every 15-minute drug visit, okay? Mm-hmm. But if you talk to someone for an hour, you don't get four times the amount that you get for that 15-minute visit.
Right. Yeah.
So this is what, basically funneled psychiatrists into this business of just being drug prescribers in the United States. It was the most financially lucrative thing for them to do.
And I also wonder, a personal psychological thing, because my girlfriend's actually studying to be a psychologist and maybe become a psychiatrist later, I don't know. And I also think that doesn't it require a huge personal investment? I mean, let's say you have all these people who are not well mentally, it'll suck you in. And if you get engaged in all these people, I mean, what toll will that take on your own mental health? So if you give them a pill that removes you, your personal involvement, and it kind of saves your sanity maybe a little bit. Is that a factor?
Well, we know that in medicine, there's something called the allopathic compulsion. In other words, patients come to doctors looking for something to be done. And we've been trained to want to go to a doctor and come home with a prescription. So it fits that ritual. So yes, I think there is a sense that it takes less of emotional toll if you're just a prescriber. But it's also, patients have been geared to ask for pills as well. You know, they advertisements, whatever, the general thing. They go to the psychiatrist seeking pills, thinking that they're the answer to their difficulties. The problem is, so it just doesn't work.
I mean, we could have you on for an hour, but I'm afraid we've got to wind up because the schedules work like that. So we've got about a minute. We can find your work on madinamerica.com. Roger Whittaker's books, I guess, on Amazon. Is there any way forward? What's the kind of, let's end on a kind of constructive good news future? Where can we go next to sort of put your findings into action in the best possible way? We've got a minute left, half a minute.
It's very simple, actually. You see, over and over again, human beings have great resilience, the capacity to recover from depressive episodes, anxiety episodes. In terms of kids getting control of their behavior in classrooms, that's possible too. So, and what we see over and over again, humans are responsive to environments. You create more nurturing environments, whether they be in school, work environments, social environments, you can nurture better health. And we can rely on the resilience of human beings, its inner capacity to get better. And if we have a model of care around that model, you'll see much better public health outcomes. And both the World Health Organization and the United Nations are, in fact, urging away from this biological model to more of a social determinants of health model.
Excellent. Well, I highly recommend you follow Dr. Whitaker's work. It's more environment, more and far less medicine, and we will hopefully see more cure of people cured. Thank you very much. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. Back to you.
Thanks for having me.
Next. Thank you very much. We'll have a break, and then we've got our final guest. Thanks a lot, Roger. Robert.
Hi. I'm your retirement fear. But don't be scared. You're still in pre-retirement.
Pre-retirement? Does that mean I have more time to plan?
Precisely. Here, this is pretirement.org.
Retirement savings options? Oh. Potential tax breaks?
Yep. Boo.
Oh, I could build up savings for my side hustle. This isn't scary. I'm doing it.
You got this.
Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan.
Many pollution sources can affect the air you breathe, from power plants and vehicles to dust and wildfires. Knowing more about local air quality can help you protect your health. If you're thinking about buying an air sensor, EPA has a series of videos to help you get the most out of it. Learn how EPA collects and uses regulatory data, how EPA communicates health messaging, and how to interpret the readings from your sensor. Visit epa.gov/air-sensor-toolbox.
Propaganda versus the truth. You're with Swedish-British journalist Pelle Neroth Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to our final guest on this Thursday afternoon. We've got a very sad tale next, a very, very tragic story, but also a tale of resilience and working hard with immense sorrow, because who can be more, what is more tragic than losing a son or a daughter? So we've got Scott Shara, who's the host of the podcast Deprogramming with Grace's Dad, who'd realized he'd been programmed to believe a litany of things that weren't true after the medical murder, in his words, of his daughter, Grace. Grace Shara is a beautiful 19-year-old with Down syndrome who died on the 13th of October, 2021 in a hospital after being given a lethal combination of meds. On the final day of her life, the doctor proclaimed how well Grace was doing, but he unilaterally labeled Grace's DNR, which is do not resuscitate, after administering a combination of IV sedatives and narcotics over a short time frame that no one could survive, especially if already in respiratory distress, as Grace was. After extensive research and investigation into the hospital's COVID protocols and financial incentives, Scott Shara, her father, determined that the hospital had decided that Grace Shara was worth more dead than alive to them, noting that the hospital recorded COVID-19 pneumonia as the second cause of death in order for the hospital to receive a killing bonus from the government. Welcome to the show, Scott. These are very sad words coming from you. What can you tell us this tragic story from the beginning? I think we've got 15 minutes or so.
Sure, I'll be glad to. Thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to be able to tell the story. So Grace was 19 when she had her last day on Earth, and Grace had Down syndrome. And I believe, based on the review of the records, the combination of her Down syndrome and the fact that we never vaccinated Grace ultimately caused her death, you know, and I'm jumping to the end, and I'll just give you a quote from the doctor's first day doctor's report, and that will help you see what I'm talking about. So this was the COVID expert, Pelle, on the wing that Grace was on. And not only did he mention in his first day report that she had Down syndrome four different times, he referenced that we were Christian, and his last line of his first day report says, "Unfortunately, I think the patient probably would not be here if she had been fully vaccinated." So you can see the bias was already there in the first day report. But what happened was, on October 6th, we had been monitoring Grace's oxygen really foolishly. We had bought a pulse ox, which is a meter that you put on your finger to monitor your oxygen saturation. And we had foolishly bought that because we were following the FLCCC protocol, the alternative protocol to the mainstream. So we were a little bit awake, but not fully. And that number dropped to 88% on the morning of October 6th. The protocol said if the number drops to 94% or below, admit yourself to the hospital. So we took Grace to the hospital. She just had a cold. But when we got to the emergency room, the ER physician suggested admitting Grace to the hospital for 3-4 days, putting her on oxygen and a steroid. And I thought, well, that makes sense as a preventative. At this point, I mean, I had no idea that there is an agenda. I had no idea the hospitals, which I had previously thought were a safe zone, were in on it. But ultimately, the fear of losing our daughter got me to make that decision. So I was with Grace from October 6th until the 10th. I was taken out by an armed guard on the 10th. During the 47 hours where we had to hire an attorney to negotiate with the hospital attorney to get my daughter Jessica in as a replacement, the hospital started sedating Grace instead of taking care of her. Now that we have the first lawsuit to expose this behavior, and the jury trial is coming up in November. But as we overlay, you know, the phone records with the medical records and everything that happened, we see that, you know, without giving us any informed consent whatsoever, they started Grace on a sedation med on October 9th. That med is called Presidex. The goal of putting somebody on Presidex is they want to set up a ventilator. And the reason they want to set up a ventilator is because a ventilator, you had mentioned the death bonus in the open. Well, there's much bigger bonuses. There's a $39,000 bonus for putting somebody on a ventilator. And when you add up the hospital stay relative to a ventilator patient, it's about a $300,000 payday to the hospital. And as we go to Grace's last day, which I'll give you in a moment, you'll see the pressure. They're trying to get my wife, Cindy, and I to approve a ventilator. Grace never was a ventilator candidate, but they always frame this discussion that we want this decision on the record just in case. These type of things tend to happen in the middle of the night when we can't get a hold of the family. So we want you and your wife to make this decision just in case. Well, we had done research while Grace was in the hospital and saw that a ventilator should never be used with COVID. It's totally designed to be used based on government incentives, and that's why the hospitals were pushing it. So anyway, as we get now to, we turn the page to Grace's last day. So during the 47 hours, remember I said Grace started on Presidex October 9th. I'm taken out October 10th. Now 47 hours without advocacy, they increased the dose of Presidex 6 different times. So they sedated my little buddy instead of taking care of her. Now my daughter Jessica's in the room October 12th, and we turn the page now to October 13th, Grace's last day on earth. Now she's on Presidex for 4 full days at this point. The package insert for Presidex says to not use that drug for more than 24 hours, because if you do, it causes acute respiratory failure, which, you know, interestingly, they told the truth as to the first cause of death on Grace's death certificate. It says literally acute respiratory failure with hypoxemia, which is a cause and effect for using Presidex for more than 24 hours, but it gets substantially worse. So now the doctor called my wife, Cindy, and I that morning, and the purpose of the call was for the 5th attempt to get us to pre-authorize a ventilator. So this call started a little after 10 o'clock in the morning. He said, what's your decision on the ventilator? He's following up on a call the night before. We said, we're not doing that. So instantly he goes to plan B. And he said, Grace had such a good day yesterday, which we knew, in spite of being sedated, she had such a good day that we should work on nutrition and we should get her out of bed today, get her bowels moving so that we can get her out of here in the next several days. Well, that was a lie. And it's easily proven when you overlay the phone records with the medical records, because he had already ordered Grace strapped down to the bed and made her defecate in the bed before the call. Then while we were on the call, he increased the Presidex to the maximum allowable dose. And simultaneous with hanging up the call, he put an illegal do not resuscitate order on Grace. And then going back to your open, the combination of meds, what they ended up doing, once they decided that Grace should no longer live, they took Presidex and combined it with lorazepam and morphine. And those three drugs, if you're not familiar with them, are used to euthanize somebody in their last half hour of life in hospice care. And they combine those meds in a 29-minute window. And that's what got me realizing that Grace was murdered. And when it came time to revive her, now my daughter Jessica is in the room with Grace. She feels her getting cold. We have no idea this is even going on. And so she started panicking and called my wife, Cindy, and I on a FaceTime call and said, "Dad, Grace's numbers are dropping like crazy." I said, "Get the nurses in." She said, "I've been trying. They refuse." So we started screaming through the FaceTime call to the nurses, "Save our daughter." Jessica said there was about 30 nurses outside the door because of shift change, and there was a guard posted outside of Grace's door. And this is when we learned she was labeled DNR because they hollered back, "She's DNR." And we screamed, "She's not DNR, save our daughter." And no medical staff, doctor or nurse came in that room and to do anything. We literally watched her die on the FaceTime call while the staff stood outside the door and did nothing. You know, and praise God, we have the door opened up for a lawsuit, and you know, we're full steam ahead on the lawsuit to hopefully expose this and save other people, because this is huge. It's not just Grace's death anymore. This type of thing happened to 1.2 million Americans in hospitals during the 39-month COVID era. 1.2 million were murdered in some type of fashion like this to set up the fear porn for the jab. And that's why we're getting this story out. So thank you for letting me cover the whole thing. I know you probably
fantastic. I mean, you've told it brilliantly. And it could, of course, if it becomes your story and your lawsuit wins, it'll become, I mean, there'll be enormous payouts, and it can change the politics of the United States, presumably. What are you hoping from it? Do you think there'll be some financial compensation for you? I mean, of course, they're probably not the main. Casting aspersions on it in any way. I just wonder if what outcomes there could be realistically.
I wish more people would ask that question, because it's a great question, and it's based on the fact that God is leading this whole thing. We told him when we jumped in that whatever doors you open, we'll walk through. And so consequently, the lawsuit, we're funding our own lawsuit, and that allows us to not settle. So you start with that premise. We filed the lawsuit against Ascension Hospital System, which is the largest Catholic hospital system in the United States. We also filed against 5 doctors and 2 nurses. And the reason we took that extraordinary step is because people make decisions. Hospitals don't. People do. And people have to be held to account. So then now you ask, what are we hoping to get out of the lawsuit? Well, praise God, we have a medical battery claim. So that means we are outside of the state statute with medical malpractice limits. So there's no limit to the payout. And so that has the opportunity to be a big payout. We've already said we're not taking any of the money. So that is not the goal. We want to be above reproach with this. We're not taking any of the money. The goal is changing behavior. And so consequently, the primary goal is for the doctors and nurses who did this to Grace to repent. Because if they repent, that means the behavior following from repentance has to change. And that means they would also be out like I am explaining what's happening. Because this is so big. It has nothing to do with COVID. It has to do with standards of care that are designed to hasten death. And these standards of care are what doctors and nurses blindly follow to keep their paychecks, because if they don't follow the standards of care, they can be sued. And if they don't follow the standards of care, they can lose their license. So that's the bigger situation that we're trying to expose here. And we're hoping the lawsuit does that. But you know, ultimately, we're hoping for repentance.
Can I just get some kind of clarification? Because I might have missed it. You wanted the ventilator. There's a financial incentive for using ventilators, which is, there's a moral hazard there, obviously. And I'm not up to speed. I'm very anti the mainstream view of COVID and the treatment there. But was it true that the ventilators created increased mortality? They were bad for patients, or were they of some use to patients?
That's a fantastic question. So first, ventilators, how they became a push is there was a public health emergency. And once the public health emergency was put in place, the FDA put protocols in place that were called emergency use authorizations, and the ventilator was part of that. The ventilator itself has a 90% kill rate. Only 10% of the people with COVID, when put on a ventilator, survived the hospital stay. And most of those people who walked out had major complications in the first 12 months. So it was something that should have never been used, similar to remdesivir. Mm-hmm. Remdesivir had a 75% kill rate, but they kept using, that was the, you know, Grace didn't have remdesivir or a ventilator. So her case is quite unique, but go ahead.
Sorry, I missed that point. They wanted to use a ventilator, and were you up to speed on how bad it was? I mean, is that where you intervened?
Yes, I had done the research literally while I was in the hospital. I was under the ventilator paradigm that President Trump had put in place to say, you know, we have a ventilator shortage. I'm going to implement the War Powers Act. So that was my mindset. I thought it was just a tool in the tool chest. But when they started pressuring, I thought, I wonder what's going on here. So I started digging while Grace was in the hospital and found that, this is the kiss of death.
She was not on a ventilator, but they put her on this cocktail of drugs that which led to her death, illegal amounts, basically. Do you think that was there any way at any point that she could have survived any of this? Do you think if they had neglected to put those, if they hadn't put those drugs in or but treated her a certain way, when she came into hospital, was there a chance of her to survive, do you think?
Oh, 100%. And the reason I say that is because I went into a different hospital 3 days after Grace died, and I was substantially worse. When we took Grace to the hospital, she just had a cold, but we were fearful of COVID. And so we took her to the hospital. When I went to the hospital 3 days later, I had to have my wife drive me, and I couldn't breathe. You know, I was having a hard time breathing. I just about died on October 16th. That hospital turned me around in 24 hours with oxygen, steroid, and budesonide. And I was turned around in 24 hours. The hospital would have only kept Grace on oxygen and steroid, Grace would be alive today. If we would have never taken Grace to the hospital, she'd be alive today. So the hospital, it is so interesting to uncover this. And it's hard to wrap your head around it because most people start with the premise the hospital is a safe zone and doctors and nurses would never do this. And you know, the research I've been doing, I have about 3,500 hours of research in now. And that's why I have my own podcast, Deep Programming with Grace's Dad, because I'm being deprogrammed as I'm researching and I'm trying to share that with the world.
Mm. Well, that's really interesting. How much deliberate motivation? I mean, was it just because they had bad protocols, or do you think, what were they thinking when they were doing this? Are we just following the rules and they were following them bad? Or they were just trying to play it safe, or what? What was the thinking behind the way they treated your daughter?
Well, you know, I can only speculate because I don't know any of these individuals personally and I haven't asked them personally. But, you know, speculation would be, yes, following rules. We know from the Milgram obedience experiment from 1963 that even back then, 2/3 of the people would follow rules to the point of killing somebody just because their supervisor told them to do so. So I think it's partially following rules. Partially, it is the indoctrination. The training that the medical, quote, professionals have is all allopathic medicine. They are aloof. They think they follow these what are called standards of care really blindly. And it's fairly easy to prove when you think about if you were in a hospital setting as a doctor, and after the first 2 months of COVID, let's say, all of your patients that you put on remdesivir and a ventilator died, wouldn't you just start looking at other options? It's so obvious. So we had 39 months kind of this one.
And of course, it sounds like a total lack of flexibility. Well, I think we have to wind up there. I mean, you've told a beautifully resonant story and very persuasive, brilliant, very logical as well, and very tragic. And we can find you on a podcast called Deprogramming with Grace's Dad, as you mentioned earlier. I guess it's on the usual podcast app, or not, you can find it on the internet. There's X, where you're also called Deprogramming with Grace's Dad. And there's a website called ouramazinggrace.net, which has a kind of slightly broader speculation, a broader, slightly different focus, I guess. But I can highly recommend you. And I think that what you've done is shown the personal damages by this. You've put a face on what is an absolutely catastrophic policy by hospitals, which has led to countless deaths. And you put in a lawsuit that could change the world, or change America at least. So thank you very much, Scott Shara, for being on our show. And we'll have you on again, maybe. Thank you very much. This is the Pelaneros Daily Show on TNT News Talk. Thank you very much.